Welcome to Politics Up Close on KCBW. I'm Jeff Robinson. What do internet memes with Ryan Gosling and neon green lawn signs have in common? They're both part of Representative John Dugal's campaign for state auditor. The lawmaker is challenging 17-year incumbent Austin Johnson for the post, saying his opponent has been asleep at the wheel and making the case that he'll be a more aggressive watchdog for Utah taxpayers. Dugal will join us to discuss his qualifications, ideas, and his opponent's criticism that he's not a certified public accountant. Then the Davis School District's decision to pull a picture book about lesbian mothers from its library shelves is personal for Weston Clark. Not only is he a gay father himself, he graduated from and even taught in Davis County schools. He'll join us to discuss his efforts to get the book back on the shelves. Politics Up Close is coming up right after the news here on KCBW. Good morning and welcome to Politics Up Close on KCBW. I'm Jeff Robinson. With the big GOP Senate primary coming up Tuesday, the Attorney General's race and more, you may not have given much thought to the race for state auditor. That is, unless you've seen Republican Representative John Dugal's neon green lawn signs telling you to vote for Frugal Dugal or one of his internet memes featuring cats, dogs, and even actor Ryan Gosling. His campaign has attracted a lot of attention, in part because he's challenging an incumbent of 17 years, State Auditor Austin Johnson. Representative Dugal joins me now on the phone to discuss why he's running for state auditor, his track record, and what he hopes to do with the office. And, Representative, it's good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Jeff. Pleasure to be on. You mean not everybody's talking about state auditors, right?
Well, maybe they are now after listening to our show. We'll see.
Fantastic.
Listeners, join us on the air with your questions and comments for GOP state auditor candidate John Dugal. Our number is 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. Well, Representative Dugal, what motivated you to run for state auditor this year and to leave your legislative career behind?
Well, there's two parts to that. The very first thing, it's 10 years ago when I ran for the legislature, I told myself no more than 10 years in the House, and that it should be somebody else's chance to serve. I believe in change. I believe in turnover. I believe in self-imposed term limits. And so I was leaving the House, and I shocked a bunch of my colleagues because it's the number two guy in charge of the whole state budget. Announcing your retirement and just voluntarily stepping down from the House is not something that one normally does. So that's why I'm leaving the House. I just think it's always good for change and turnover. After that, I had, you know, so many folks that you know, said you can't just completely walk away and leave. And given my skill set and background, a lot of folks said you really need to run for state auditor. And as I looked at, you know, the 10-year history in the legislature, time and time again, all the major audits were coming out of the legislative branch. And the state auditor's office was kind of a sleepy office that nobody paid much attention to. You know, literally nobody's paid attention to this race for about two decades. And for a guy like me that believes the state auditor is supposed to be the constitutional watchdog for taxpayer funds, they're supposed to be out there proactively trying to mitigate problems rather than just documenting train wrecks when they happen, that was a concern to me. And so I decided to jump in the race and start shaking it up and start talking about my vision for the future.
And are you running against incumbent auditor Austin Johnson because you have serious problems with the way he runs the office, or is it just that you think you can do a better job?
Both. I mean, his strength, his focus has been the annual financial statement audits, and that is one duty of the office. But when you look at what's authorized for the office, when it comes to the compliance office, you know, audits that are done, whether agencies and local governments are following the law, we need to step it up and do a better job on those type of things. When it came to issues with the Department of Alcoholic Beverage Control, etiquette, and so forth, I think those are things that the state auditor should have been out there actively pursuing those things. When it comes to performance audits, this is a big thing I've talked about on the campaign. The office has not been doing performance audits. And performance audits are where you measure the efficiency and effectiveness of government programs, start to hold those programs accountable, document to the public and to, you know, lawmakers, here's what's really going on with these programs. And I think that's critical to root out waste in government. And so I've been pushing hard on that issue because I think that helps make government more accountable to the public.
This is Politics Up Close on KCBW. We're speaking with State Representative John Dugal. He's a candidate for Utah State Auditor this year. You can join us on the phone if you'd like. 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. And John, let's go into that a little more specifically, the role of the State Auditor. As you mentioned, the legislature has its own auditor that does performance audits. We've seen audits of UTA and the Department of Alcoholic Beverage Control and other various agencies in recent years. Uncovering significant problems with some of these agencies. How is the role of the state auditor a little bit different from that, and what's your vision for what that office will do if you win this race?
So the legislative auditor general is not an independent office. They only look at issues requested by one or more legislators and prioritized by the audit committee. And they typically are the last resort. You know you've got a serious problem by the time they're stepping in, and basically they're applying the ground, preparing for major legislative change. From my perspective, the role of state auditor is supposed to be that independent early warning system, trying to prevent train wrecks from happening, trying to oversee what's going on in state and local governments to mitigate and deal with these issues well in advance. We look at the issue that came out recently about Tempview High School, and I sit there, and rather than documenting what somebody already found, I think the state auditor should have been much more aggressive early on, trying to make sure school districts know proper money management, know where the line is between booster clubs and school activities, making sure they're training the independent auditors appropriately, because I sit there and ask the question, well, where were the auditors all along the way to detect when this activity was going on rather than well after the fact? I mean, it sounds like this has been going on for years, and it's not just something at Tempview High School. It sounds like it's going on at many places. Mm-hmm. And so that's the key thing, is to be out there early. And one of the key things I talk about is leveraging technology. Technology is very powerful these days. And when we talk, for example, there was an audit report a few weeks ago about misuse of purchase cards, these credit cards you give to your state employees. Well, I contend what we should have is computer algorithms that on a daily basis are monitoring those transactions and detecting where there's fraudulent activity or misuse of those cards and promptly reporting that to the employee and to the manager, the supervisor, so you can get in there quickly and solve issues early on rather than waiting for 6 or 9 months to elapse and then coming in well after the fact with just a little statistical analysis.
John, you're calling yourself Utah's watchdog on this campaign. Do you have a record of being a watchdog in the Utah legislature? And if so, where exactly? Is it any specific bill or your role in budgeting? Where have you served as a watchdog for Utah in the past 10 years?
Well, you know, some of my colleagues call me a budget proctologist. But for that visual graphic. But, a major part of that is in my role in the legislature over 10 years and in my budget role. You know, when I oversaw the Health and Human Services Committee, was trying to bring more accountability within what was going on with Medicaid, Human Services, trying to make that more accountable to the public. If you know anything about Medicaid, it's growing out of control. And so Senator Lilienquist and I teamed together on some Medicaid reform to try and bend the cost curve to make that accountable, pushing the agencies to be more responsive. When it came to UDOT, one of the very first things I did in the legislature was say, I think the concept of doing deals for who gets roads in the back room is a bad idea. And so I pushed early on to bring transparency to the prioritization process for UDOT, to require them to put out the criteria they're going to use. And so this is Transportation Commission that oversees those activities. Put out the criteria they're going to use to judge projects and prioritize them, publish that to the public, and bring transparency to that process so we let science start driving what goes on rather than just who has the most political clout. When it comes to tax reform, I'm always looking to say, where can we be more efficient? Where can we cut taxes to return money back to the citizens? Because I fundamentally believe people know better how to spend their money than the government does. And when they work so hard, I mean, on the campaign trail, I hear time after time after time, people talking about the burden of taxes on their families, on their businesses, the burden of regulation. And so bringing, you know, accountability to government and getting it out of their lives and letting them keep more of their money I think it's a good thing.
We're speaking with John Dugal. He's a state representative and a candidate for state auditor in this election. He'll face a primary election coming up on June 26 against incumbent auditor Austin Johnson. Send us your questions on Twitter at KCPW. John, at the Republican State Convention earlier in the spring, you received the support of Senate President Michael Wattups and House Speaker Becky Lockhart. Senator Howard Stevenson, though, I noted, supported your opponent, Austin Johnson, saying, you know, we should keep the auditor's office boring. That was one of his arguments. What kind of support are you getting from other lawmakers and elected officials as you run for this office, and are you encountering some opposition as well?
Well, I'm getting a lot of good support as I talk with citizens around the state, elected officials, and so forth. They want to see, you know, activity out of the auditor's office. As I talk with local officials, they talk about their desire to get better training to make sure that they can prevent issues from happening. They talk about wanting to get, you know, oversight early on so they can make small corrective actions before it becomes serious problems down the road. Mm-hmm. They want, you know, I've talked with elected officials who say we want to be able to go to the state auditor's office to get some advice of what we're doing. We get an independent party telling us, are we okay or is there issues there? And they say time and time again, we've been told, you know, don't bother us with your problems, deal with it yourself. I don't think that's acceptable. And when it comes, you know, some people talk about, you know, legislative support. One of the key things that I get in terms of my colleagues is they know they've watched me for 10 years. They watch me ask the hard questions of state agents. Hmm. They watch me push for accountability in government. And they want to see more of that taking place. They really want to see somebody who's looking in depth and has a vision for the future to say, how do we improve oversight? And how do we quickly identify, you know, waste, you know, fraud and stuff like that in government? If you look at activities, for example, DADC, you know, rather than having something that was documented that went on for 15 years, where the state auditor had written memos in 1995, 1999, 2002, and that was it. And when the legislature found out about this, to me, it's a problem. You don't let something like that just go on for 15 years. You need to be active, engaging policymakers to make sure they know this is an issue you really need to care about, and this is why. And in a case like that, you can leverage technology to monitor their purchasing transaction to see and detect fraudulent activities, to see, you know, start detecting when they're splitting invoices and other things like that. And we just need to have a few, you know, a vision for doing, you know, that kind of proactive engagement to disrupt the status quo. You know, the state auditor has a hotline that he likes to talk a lot about. But most folks I talk to don't even know the hotline exists. And when you go out to the website, one of the things you do is print out a form, fill it out, fax it in. I contend in a world in the 21st century, rather than have an online submission form, somebody can type it in, they get a case number, they can start tracking, has it been reviewed, has it been looked at, what's the status? So they kind of know what's going on, rather than, you know, being silent and most people not even knowing. One of the key things in oversight is you got to engage the public to help you identify where there's risks, where there's potential problems.
This is Politics Up Close on KCBW. We're speaking with John Dugal, a state lawmaker and candidate for Utah State Auditor. John, we're going to take a short break, be back in just a minute, and talk more about the auditor's race. You're listening to Politics Up Close here on NPR Utah, KCBW. You're listening to Politics Up Close here on KCBW. I'm Jeff Robinson, talking now with John Dugal. He's a Republican candidate for Utah State Auditor, and he will face a primary election coming up June 26th. That's next Tuesday, against incumbent auditor Austin Johnson. Join us on the air at 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. John, one of your campaign slogans is John Dugal, more than a CPA, as in more than a certified public accountant. And, of course, you know your opponent has made an issue about this, him being a CPA and you not being a CPA. Tell me about that slogan and tell me what you think about that issue of, you know, bringing up whether or not you're a CPA in this race.
Well, if this race were only about the annual financial statement audits,
mm-hmm.
great. Make it an appointed position for a CPA. But this job is much more than that. There's a reason why this is an elected constitutional office. It is supposed to do much more than just those annual financial statement audits. It's supposed to be that watchdog as I described. And I believe I bring a greater skill set. I tell folks I've got a bachelor's and master's degree in electrical engineering. I have an MBA, the accounting and finance that comes with that. I'm a businessman. I come from a business perspective.
Mm-hmm.
That's where performance comes in. That's why that's so critical. And then I also bring, obviously, a 10-year part-time legislator history, being the number two guy in charge of the state budget. And so I bring that greater skill set of I understand the legislative process. I understand policy and intent of the legislature. I understand the budget. I understand business, having worked, my entire career in the public sector, or in the private sector, mm-hmm. and only, limited time as a lawmaker in the public sector. I believe I bring a greater skill set when it comes to that. I bring a different perspective. And so I'm not stuck in that typical traditional rut of a CPA. And so I can be a disruptive innovator rather than just defending the status quo. As you look nationwide, I know my opponent likes to make a big deal about you've got to be a CPA.
Mm-hmm.
Well, only 12 states nationwide have state auditors, comptrollers, and so forth that are CPAs. So this is not the norm, nationwide. And I believe, the trend is to say people with greater skill sets coming in to say, how do we improve what's going on in the state auditor's office?
Could you tell me a little bit more about your private sector background then, John, and specifically any experience you have when it comes to management? Obviously, this is an office where you have several employees who report to you. Are you an experienced manager?
Yes. So in companies I've worked with in technology, I've been vice president of engineering,
mm-hmm.
Overseeing a sizable engineering team, working on innovative technology. Radar systems, wireless systems, and so forth. Chief operating officer for a startup technology company, trying to change the way we deal with information technology. And so, yes, I've got a history of doing that. Currently, I serve as a consultant. So I work with high-tech companies, in Utah and in other states, and helping them. And I work with them on any of a number of things. Some I deal with, accounting, finance, legal, operations, helping them get themselves off the ground. Others I deal with evaluating business opportunities. They don't necessarily want to corrupt their intellectual property with that of another company, and so mm-hmm. they'll hire me to come in and say, okay, evaluate the opportunity. Look to say, is there a good relationship for us to continue to meet, or should we walk away from this kind of deal? And starting to evaluate the financial benefits of a potential partnership. So that's kind of my background.
We're speaking with John Dougal, a candidate for Utah State Auditor. He'll face a primary election coming up on June 26. When it comes to your role in the legislature, John, and your role in crafting the state budget, as you said, as the number two person in charge of that, what do you think you've brought to the table when it comes to trimming waste from state spending, making sure the state's revenues are being spent appropriately? Perhaps any specific examples from recent years that you could give us about that?
Certainly. In 2007, I was the House sponsor of the largest tax cut the state's ever seen. This was part of the tax reform that the governor had. I think that was critical, one, to leave more money in people's pocket, and two, to put in a more competitive tax environment in Utah as we were competing in the region. And so that was one of the key things. When it came to dealing with personal property tax, trying to simplify that for business and streamline that process. It's a very onerous type of process for most businesses,
mm-hmm.
and try to bring accountability there. Time and time, when it comes to various, agencies, it's asking them and pushing them what's going on with their budget. Obviously, having to be the chair, the House chair of the Health and Human Services Committee during an economic downturn, it's going line by line through that budget, identifying which things are critical, which things are not, working with those agency heads and striking things out of there.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I sponsored a couple of years ago was because performance is such a critical thing to me, Senator Niederhauser and I came together on legislation to start requiring performance audits of any new program or significant expansion of existing programs, to start down that path of really pushing performance assessment of government programs. It is really easy for people to run a bill with good intentions to create something, but if you don't measure the performance, you don't know whether that intention actually translates into what you want on the ground.
John, I want to
Outside of that, one of the other key things, I talk a lot about transparency. I think transparency is critical. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, when you talk transparency, it's trying to get data in a manner the public can use. And so when it comes to transparency, one of the key things I pushed was the creation of the public meeting notice website, where people can get electronic notices when city council, school boards, and so forth are meeting. So they can be engaged. They don't have to actually go to the city building to find out what's on the agenda. It can be sent right to them. Sarah Niederhauser and I once again teamed together to create the financial transparency website. Mm-hmm. This is something that allows the public to dive in essentially into the check registers for state and local government. So they can actually see where their money's going. One anecdotal story is a couple years ago, the Salt Lake Tribune reported about how much state government was spending on bottled water. Well, they did that because of this website. They were able to drill in, search, analyze, started reporting that to the public that the state was spending almost $250,000. And the public said that's outrageous. That helped bring accountability to what was going on in terms of state spending. You know, that website's also used to put out, you know, on Utah's Right to Know, how much government employees are being paid. So the public can start questioning, is that okay? Is that too low or is that too much? And I think that's important to engage the public with information and data that they can use to help oversee government.
John, as you know, when it comes to transparency, the issue that your opponent brings up is the fact that you were the sponsor of House Bill 477 dealing with open records in Utah, restricting access to things like text messages sent by public officials. And your opponent uses this to make the case that you stand in opposition to transparency and not in favor of it. Talk about that issue and, you know, what your response is when you hear criticism about HB 477.
Well, it's one of those things. What's the saying? There's two things you don't want to watch, lawmaking and the making of sausage.
Yep.
The legislative process is a messy process. What you really need to focus on is the outcome. And I tell folks they need to look at Senate Bill 177, which passed this last session. Senator Bramble and I teamed together on that bill. It was the outcome of the working group that we had over the summer and discussions with various interested parties. It was a bill that helped clarify issues in regards to grandma. Where various lines are, bringing consistency in terms of court rulings versus statute, creating the public records ombudsman. And that legislation won rave reviews for openness, transparency, and so forth. 477, as I said from the day one, is not an end goal. This is to force the discussion about that topic. And I was willing to touch an issue that people said, no, it shouldn't be touched. I'd seen an issue that had languished and had been festering for years while I was in the legislature, and I wanted to bring some resolution to it. And so running that legislation stirred up a discussion, which led to Senate Bill 177, which I think was a great outcome. It was a painful process, absolutely, but I'm not afraid to deal with difficult issues to try and bring a good outcome.
If you were given the opportunity to do that over a representative, would you go about it the same way, given the outcome, or is there another way that you would have approached the issue that wouldn't have led to, for example, the governor having to call a special session to repeal that that bill?
Well, hindsight's always 20/20, and so when you have more information, I would have approached it a different way, a different dynamic, but given the information at the time, you know, pushing forward and saying, okay, let's try and get something to force this discussion, you know, that was the best that I had at that time. And given what you know now, there's a different strategy and different approach. But I still think getting to the outcome, the resolution of Senate Bill 177 was a good outcome.
Representative, I want to talk a little bit about the way you're campaigning for this seat. You know, you have a lot of kind of funny internet memes on your Twitter and Facebook accounts, you know, cats and dogs and Ryan Gosling and things all across the board, various funny internet photos you're using to draw attention to your campaign. What are some of your favorite memes you're using online here?
Well, you know, one of my favorite was Granny lifting her glasses, peering at the computer saying, "We have a state auditor? Why am I just finding out about this now?"
And do you find that those are working, that people are paying more attention because of them?
Yeah, I mean, it's engaging the public in a race, like I've said, that nobody paid attention to in two decades. And I think it's good for people to start learning, one, we actually do have a state auditor, and two, start to put out, you know, policy aspects So they start understanding what the role is and what is the job of the state auditor and why it's important.
This is Politics Up Close on KCBW. We have a few minutes left here with State Representative John Dugal. He's a Republican running for Utah State Auditor and will face incumbent Auditor Austin Johnson in a primary election coming up on Tuesday, June 26th. John, your opponent, as you know, makes the case that you don't understand what the constitutional authority of the state auditor's office is, that in your campaign that you've been misrepresenting what the auditor actually does, and that the auditor's role is, in fact, perhaps a lot more boring than you make it out to be. How do you respond to that? How do we know, you know, which of you truly has a better handle on what the auditor is, what the auditor's role is and what it's supposed to do?
Well, I guess it's unfortunate that after 17 years of state auditor, he doesn't understand what his job is, and that's part of why I'm campaigning. But if I sit there and listen to what he describes the job as, and if you look at the Constitution, it says post-performance audits and essentially other duties as assigned by statute. So who assigns by statute? That's the legislature. So then when I look over at the legislature, and the president, the speaker, and others, and when they start saying, well, here's what should be happening over there, I have to look at the policymakers who pass statute, you know, and that's the intent of the legislature for what the office should be doing. And so I would contend that he needs to actually understand what his job is rather than just trying to make it the narrow focus that he's comfortable with. I know I'm disrupting the status quo. Mm-hmm. I know I'm forcing him out of a comfortable rut as a 36-year career bureaucrat. That's uncomfortable. But that is what I do. I make people question their deeply held beliefs, and say, hey, guess what? You're not doing your job.
As you've probably seen by now, John, the Utah Association of CPAs has actually produced an online video criticizing your campaign. One of the points they make, speaking about the legislature, is the support you've received of the Senate President and Speaker Becky Lockhart, and the video suggests that this is in some way nefarious and suggesting that perhaps you would be in the auditor's office to do the bidding of state legislative leaders. Is there any truth to that at all?
Absolutely not. And the whole concept that a private special interest group should control this office should be troubling to the citizens of Utah. So to let a private group dictate who can be in this office, unacceptable. What my legislative colleagues want to see is they want to see action come out of this office. They want to see improved oversight of government. They don't want to see issues like DABC that festered for 15 years where the office knew about it and didn't adequately raise that issue to the public and to elected officials. They want to see somebody who's more proactive in terms of, when you look at Medicaid, in theory, the state auditor's in there year after year after year auditing. Yet for years, we had payment and billing errors going on. Unacceptable. When it comes to things like the Tim Pugh High School, state auditor comes in after somebody else found the issue to document the train wreck. Where was the state auditor's office years and years in the future trying to mitigate and prevent these type of issues? We need somebody in the state auditor's office who understands how to be proactive, who isn't going to just sit back and be a reactionary and document the train wreck, but is going to be out there trying to put the tools and techniques and principles in place so that folks know, here's good fiscal principles. Here's good fiscal discipline. Here is transparency to the public. Here's the data in a manner that they can analyze and oversee to try and prevent these problems and try and mitigate these problems. And when they come up, catch them when they're small rather than allow them to just destroy people's careers and lives.
And finally, John, let me ask you, why does the outcome of Tuesday's primary election matter? When you're making your case to voters as to the real impact the outcome of this race could have on their lives, what are you telling them?
Well, bad government is expensive government. And fundamentally, people want good government. They want limited government, but they want that limited government to be good. They want it to be efficient. They want it to be effective. And that matters to their pocketbook, and that matters to their lives. And that's why this race is important. We've got to keep doing those annual financial statements. We've got to step it up and do a better job of compliance. We've got to put in place performance audits. We've got to start leveraging technology to help improve that oversight. That's why it matters to them.
We've been speaking with State Representative John Dugal. He's a Republican candidate for Utah Auditor and will face a primary election this Tuesday, June 26, against incumbent auditor Austin Johnson. John, thank you very much for your time. It's been a pleasure having you on Politics Up Close.
Hey, Jeff. Thanks. Take care.
This is Politics Up Close here on NPR Utah, KCBW. I'm Jeff Robinson, and we'll be right back. When the Davis School District decided to remove a picture book telling the story of a family with two moms from its library shelves, it was personal for my next guest this morning, Weston Clark. That's because Clark's own son is being raised by two dads, he and his partner Brandon. But that's not the only reason this issue hits home for him. He's also a graduate and former teacher in the Davis School District. He joins me now in the studio to discuss what the district's decision to remove In Our Mother's House from the shelves means to him and what he would like to see done about it. And Weston, good to have you in the studio.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, join us on the air with your questions and comments on this issue. What do you think of the school district's decision to pull this book and require parental permission for students to check it out? Our number is 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Well, Weston, to start off, give us a reminder what this book, In Our Mother's House, is about exactly.
It's essentially a book about two mothers who adopted three children of different races, and basically growing up together and spending family time together, sharing holiday time together, and that's pretty much it.
What do you think is the advantage of students being able to read this book in young children or older children in particular?
Well, I think it has many purposes. One is it's validating. It's validating to students who might be in the same type of family. It's also, I think, shows students or children who may not be in that type of family that type of family exists and that they are normal and that there's nothing scary about them.
So how did you learn that this book had been pulled off the shelves? Was it simply from watching the news, or did you hear from somebody in Davis County?
Yeah, it was simply from watching the news, which was apparently months after the process started. And that's something that's been kind of interesting through the process is we've learned that, it was a very quiet process from the beginning. I believe it started in January where the petition started. Even the Davis School District's Equity Committee, which is charged with, looking at issues like this, didn't even know about it until it hit the press. So, it was, I believe that there was an attempt to keep it as quiet as possible from the beginning.
What was your immediate reaction when you learned the book had been pulled?
Well, I think living in Utah, I think there's a lot of eye rolling that happens when you see something like this happen. But, it really hit home, as you stated in the introduction. It's personal to me. I also have a lot of nieces and nephews who are going or will be going to public school in Davis School District. I may one day have a job again in Davis School District if I choose to go back to work. And, I don't want them. My family is very accepting and has done a great job of making my family very much an equal part of my larger family. And I don't want them to in any way think that my family is less than theirs or that we're different for my sake, for their sake, and for my son's sake.
And so you mentioned the eye rolling. Davis County is a pretty conservative place. It's represented only by Republicans in the legislature, I believe. Were you all that surprised by the news?
No, I don't think I was. I think the eye rolling shows that I expect, some of the things like this. But as I said, Davis School District, Davis County, has a special place in my heart, and I really do believe that the people are better than this there, and that this is just a lot of misinformation and misunderstanding. And what concerns me about it being such a quiet process from the beginning is, had we been able to have more of a community discussion about this from the beginning, I think there may have been a different decision made. But there's so much fear about what's going to happen and what's going to be said and those sorts of things. And it doesn't have to be combative or mean. It's a community dialogue where we learn about our neighbors and learn about each other's families and learn that there's nothing scary or inappropriate about anybody's family.
We're speaking with Weston Clark about Davis School District and its recent decision to pull the picture book In Our Mother's House from the shelves and require students to have parental permission to check it out. You can join us on the air with your opinions on this matter, 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. You can also send your tweets to us on at KCPW. Tell me about your experience with Davis School District Weston, both as a student and then later coming back as a teacher.
I had a great experience going to Orchard Elementary and South Davis Junior High School and Woods Cross High School, all in Davis School District. You know, it was as growing up gay, it was had the normal difficulties that it has for, you know, anybody across the country. Mm-hmm. You know, we had some particular incidents. You know, it was a different time. It amazes me how different times are from back then to today. Mm-hmm. You know, we had an incident that I've mentioned to a lot of people that it was right during the Gay Straight Alliance stuff that was coming out. And we also had this huge drug bust at Woods Cross High School where a lot of students were arrested. And the student body president got up in an assembly and made the comment, at least we don't have gays at our school. Tough. And, you know, obviously that's completely false. And as we've distanced our time from high school, it was not only false in my case, but many other students' cases. And that's, you know, and that's the thing that we have to understand is that decisions like this aren't affecting LGBT families. They're affecting people, they're affecting students who might be gay or might be questioning that they're gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender. And I think we need to understand that these decisions are very serious. And, if I was in Davis School District and my son was going to Davis School District schools, it's not fair to him. You know, hate me all you want. I wish you wouldn't, but if that's what you choose to do, if you choose to fill your life with hate and hate me for who I am, then that's great. But what about my son? He had no choice in the matter. You know, we adopted him, and I think we're providing him with an amazing childhood and amazing life. But he's the real victim of this. And the other students, the students who might be LGBT in Davis School District, they're the real victims. I mean, this is bigger than a book. And I don't know that everybody understands that. This is setting aside a group of people. Some people give me a hard time for using the word segregation on Twitter, but that's exactly what it is. We're setting aside a group of people, putting them behind the counter, and requiring people who might be interested in that, reading about these families, are going to have to go through a special process to have that access. And that's, you know, completely inappropriate and harkens back to times we like to forget in this country.
Well, let's focus on that a little bit more, because I'm sure the response of the school district is the book is still available and that parents should have as much a choice as possible in what their children read. As long as they give their permission, then students can check it out. Why is that not a valid argument from your perspective?
Well, and like I just said, I mean, it's requiring a special process. I mean, I can't imagine that an elementary school student would actually go to their parent and say, "Mom, Dad, or Dad, I want to get this book. I know where it is. It's behind the librarian's desk. So I'm going to go get. I need a parental slip, and then I'm going to go get this book." I mean, can you imagine a student actually doing that? And if they did, to have to go to the librarian and ask for it, I think is might in that sort of environment. The scrutiny that they would bear, it would be crazy. I also want to mention one other thing. In doing the research for this, I came across the Library Media Policy Manual for Davis School District. And in that policy manual, they adopted this section that's called the Freedom to Read. And it has some bullet points, and I really suggest everybody look it up because it's pretty amazing. It's pretty powerful. And it talks about the responsibility that librarians have in a community have with a library and how important having free access to information and different ideas are. One of the bullets is, "It is in the public interest for publishers and librarians to make available the widest diversity of views and expressions, including those which are unorthodox or unpopular with the majority." Another one says, and this one's right to your question, "It is not in the public interest to force a reader to accept with any book the prejudgment of a label characterizing the book or author as subversive or dangerous." And that's exactly what they're doing. By putting it behind the counter and requiring a parental slip, they are prejudging a book. They're putting a label on a book that a reader should not have to go through in order to read those ideas.
This is Politics Up Close. We're speaking with Weston Clark. He is a father here in Salt Lake City, former teacher and student in Davis School District. We're talking about the district's recent decision to move the In Our Mother's House book from the shelves. It's a book about a family that has two moms. Join us on the air, 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. Weston, let's step back from this issue for a minute and tell our listeners a little bit about your own family and about you and Brandon's son.
Well, he's almost 2 years old. We adopted him out of Kansas, actually, Wichita, Kansas, which is his mom still lives there, and we talk to her occasionally. And, you know, we're as exciting as I want to make that question, it's going to be a boring one because the reality is we're just like any other family. You know, Brandon goes to work. I stay home with Xander. We go to the zoo a lot. We go to the park a lot. You know, it's just like this book. There's nothing that unusual about our family. You know, I heard the word inappropriate thrown around a lot in this process, that it's inappropriate for children, you know, they would reference smaller children, whatever, reading a book like this. And I genuinely do not understand what is inappropriate about that family, about my family. You know, you talk about the straight couple that a couple years ago, you know, I bring this up a lot, the son that was visiting from back east and, and the boyfriend, you know, beat him and they left him and he died and they, you know, hit his body up in the hills. That's an inappropriate family. There's something inappropriate there. And so to place an inappropriate label, there's something much worse than inappropriate, but you know, to put an inappropriate label on it and on a type of family simply because of its makeup is ridiculous. It's ridiculous. It's, and it's, that's inappropriate.
Can I ask, Weston, have you experienced, you and Brandon and your son, Xander, experienced only acceptance in Utah so far here in Salt Lake City or outside of Salt Lake City, or have you experienced discrimination as well?
No, you know, we've had an amazing experience outside of the legislative session. When the legislature's in session, we feel like we're constantly under attack, and that's unfortunate. But on a day-to-day basis, no, absolutely not. I mean, we surround ourselves with accepting people. We've created a great community of friends and families who accept us fully, and there's just no judgment. There's no problems. And so, you know, sometimes I get so stuck in that bubble that when I see something like this happen in Davis School District or wherever, it kind of jars me a little bit, shocks me back into reality, and I realize that we've got a lot of work to do to educate people as to what our families are. But it's such an interesting process because, like I said, I don't know what we're educating them about. It's nothing. It's just there's nothing new or interesting. We're just like any other family.
I want to take a phone call in just a second, but first, you mentioned you adopted your son from Kansas. Was that simply because it was an impossibility to adopt him here in Utah because of state law, or what exactly?
Yeah, state law in Utah does not allow for same-sex couples to adopt, and so we had to, you know, go about it in a different way. You know, I feel secure in the process that we did and that it was completely above board and legal. But, you know, I wouldn't want to lay it out too clearly because I know that my family could be under attack by the legislature. They may pick up the cause and find a way to close that loophole. You know, I'm happy to share with other LGBT families. You know, and that's the message I want to send, you know, real quick to the legislature. They sit here, they go every year and try to legislate my family and legislate my life and how we live our lives. And the reality is there's always ways around it. And we'll continue to do that to live our lives to its fullest, no matter what they do.
We want to take a call from Sue. Sue is calling from Battleville. Hi, Sue. You're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted, to me, I grew up in Bountiful. My kids grew up in Bountiful. We all went to Davis County Schools. Mm-hmm. This is just heartbreaking because to me, this, you know, the parents or the district's opinion falls down around their children. And that teaches them, like Weston says, discrimination. I mean, I will approve of you or I will approve of you. It's just, to me, it's just heartbreaking. And I went to lunch with a couple of friends from the Nevada State, and they have moved here, and they were saying that Davis County, and we weren't even discussing this matter, And they were saying that Davis County is really behind and antiquated. And that kind of hurt my feelings. And I said, no, wait a minute. I live out there, and if I have most of my life, but I also lived in Colorado. Mm-hmm. And maybe that gives me a different perspective in coming back here. But I'm so with you, Weston. I just, it breaks my heart that this is happening. It really does. And if they didn't bring attention to this book, it would just, you know, go along with all the rest of the books. Don't you think?
Thank you for the call, Sue. We appreciate it very much. I imagine you identify with that, Weston.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Sue. I agree, and it's disheartening. A lot of people that I love are in Davis County, and I, like I said at the beginning, the people of Davis County are better than this. They're more accepting than this. They're more loving than this, and I don't think that this – first of all, I don't think this process in which the book was removed was even close to transparent, should have been more transparent, and I think if it were, there would be more – public scrutiny by the general public in Davis County, and I think we maybe would have had a different decision.
Sue, we appreciate your call very much. 801-355-8255 is the number. George from Salt Lake is calling. Hi, George. What's your question or comment?
Hi. I just have a comment, a question that he probably could be able to answer. This problem really is really huge. She's saying, well, nobody understands how huge it is. No, it's really huge. I'm very serious, too. In my case, I wouldn't allow, my kid to see, or read a book, and I will explain why they shouldn't do it. But my question will be, what is the purpose of the gay community? To convince everybody not to procreate, the natural way that we work for our Creator? Because eventually, everybody's going to be judged by our Creator. So that would be the question. What is the purpose of this gay community? To convince everybody not to procreate the way our Creator told us, that's my basic question.
George, it sounds like you're asking about the purpose of the gay community and bringing up whether it's natural. I guess, Weston, if you could address what is your purpose in trying to get this book put on library shelves?
Like most Americans, most people in this world, I think I don't know what my purpose in life is, and I continue to seek that every single day, but I think that's kind of the same thing as everybody else. I think the caller said something about, he wouldn't let his child read this book. And mm-hmm. I guess I'll address that. Maybe that's something I can go for, but, fine. Great. I think that's your prerogative. I think, if the parent who first started this petition on this book, decided that, when their child brought home this book, that it was something that they didn't want to read in their family, I think that is completely fine. That's their prerogative. Mm-hmm. But to go to the effort of removing it from being an option for everybody else's family, that's the problem. The caller references or makes implies that there's some sort of agenda that the LGBT community has, and we don't. Our purpose is to find acceptance and be like everybody else, and it's as simple as that. Yeah.
George, thank you for your call. Weston, in the few minutes we have left, tell me about the discussions you've had or not had with the Davis School District Board of Education. What kind of conversations have you had with their superintendent or board so far, and where do you hope those go from here?
Well, so when this happened, I decided I thought the best place to go for this was to the school board. Mm-hmm. Even though it was not a direct school board decision, it's a committee that's made up. And it outlines it a little bit in the policy manual, but it's actually a very vague process. There's really no real specifics as to who's on the board. They've told us that it's private, and they won't release the names of the people that were on it or their positions. We can't even get the 25 signatures of the people who started the petition. So I think there's some real problems with that, some transparency and potentially some legal issues that I think are being pursued. When I contacted the school board, I said, the reason I want to talk to the school board is I think we need to have a public discussion on this. This is something that the entire community needs to discuss, and the public school or the school board of this public school is a place where the public can do that. Mm-hmm. They, talking with the superintendent, he was very cool to the idea of doing a public discussion, and he acknowledged some, I think, some real fears of bringing out, you know, some nastiness on one side or both sides, and it would just be more divisive for the community. And I think there, you know, there's the potential for that. I don't think it needs to be that, but that he definitely didn't want that. So, you know, in my discussions with him, we came to an agreement that maybe we could just come in and introduce our families, be as simple as that. I think we must have had a misunderstanding in there, because he then went back on that as soon as it broke in the press. I don't know if he expected us to not go to the press, but again, you know, my purpose is to make this a larger community discussion and not just a discussion with seven board members or whatever. So ultimately, I hope our discussion moves forward. I'd like to meet with them again, and have a call in so that we can have a discussion, have a meeting, and continue to move this discussion so that Davis School District can become a model of inclusiveness in the state.
We've been speaking with Weston Clark. He is a father here in Salt Lake City, talking about the Davis School District's decision to pull the book In Our Mother's House from its library shelves, a book about two moms raising their children. Weston, we appreciate your time very much. Thank you for sharing your story here on Politics Up Close.
Thanks for having me.
Politics Up Close is a production of KCBW News. Thank you to Jesse Ellis for his help with the show. And listen to podcasts of our interviews online at kcbw.org. I'm Jeff Robinson. Thanks for joining us.